The next major celebration of our country's birth will be its 250th. Our next major celebration of women getting to vote in the country will be the 100th. That's next year, the anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, giving women the right to vote. It was a very long struggle with many parts and players. Sally Resch Wagner gives us a flavor for the long struggle in a book of writing from the people involved. She is the editor of a book called simply The Women's Suffrage Movement, with a foreword by Gloria Steinem. Sally Resch Wagner owns one of the first PhDs ever awarded in the country for women's studies. Dr. Wagner is currently adjunct faculty at Syracuse University and a member of the New York State Women's Suffrage Commission. Dr. Wagner, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm delighted to be with you.
It's very good to have you. This is clearly not your first journey down this road. What did you want to do with this particular project?
Well, I think that there is so much information that we have not learned about the women's rights movement. Suffrage, we see just the vote. In fact, they were dealing with the issues that we continue to deal with today, from equal pay to a woman's right to her own body to violence against women. And I thought that it would be valuable to have the voices of the women themselves and the male allies that supported them, to be able to read the documents, their writings, you know, instead of my saying, this is what happened, this is what they did, to take you into that moment, to take the reader, to have a direct conversation with our foremothers and forefathers.
It's, you know, I'm still struck myself by the fact that it's only been 100 years, not even, since all women got the right to vote. Do you ever step back and consider how short a time that is?
Well, you know, the perspective for me is the Native women, indigenous women, who have had political authority and voice on this land for at least 1,000 years. The Haudenosaunee or Iroquois Six Nation Confederacy, which is in the area that is now New York State, they have continued to have political voice for 1,000 years. The clan mothers in this consensus system, everyone has a voice, but the clan mothers have the responsibility for nominating, placing in position, and removing, if necessary, the chiefs or the sachem that represent the clan. One of the rules that is an absolute is that this man that they put in position cannot have abused a woman. That's continued that process for 1,000 years. Clan mothers still today traditionally are raising up the chiefs.
I have to really thank you, by the way, for opening my eyes to the real name of the Confederacy, because even as a native of New York State, we were only taught Iroquois, and I never heard Haudenosaunee until I read your book.
Oh, you know, it's the sort of arrogance of white folks that we came here and said, okay, you are this name, you are this name. And often it was the names that we heard the not terribly friendly other nations that they were calling them. The Sioux, for example, you know, it means poison adder, poison snake. And their name is Lakota Nakota Dakota, depending, on their dialect. So the Haudenosaunee are the people of the longhouse, and their confederacy is conceptualized as a longhouse, five, later six nations.
Right, with the Tuscarora coming up from North Carolina. I remember that much from seventh grade, yes.
Great.
Interesting, though, that as we follow things like Native American views on women's participation in politics, that contradictions abound in the book. One of the writers you bring to our attention is Alice Fletcher, who spent a great deal of time in Native American societies but did not feel that they should remain distinct.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that looking at the imperfect nature in which the best of the allies understood and saw what should be done, instead of listening to Native people and saying, this is what we want, this is what we're going to do, to say, this is what you need. And she, at the same time that she is really introducing suffragists, and it's an international group that she's speaking to, speech that's in the book. It's the International Council of Women in 1888. And she tells a story that's so fun. Here's this woman, she says, I'm with a group of Omaha Nation women, and one of the women gives away a horse. And without thinking, I said, hadn't you better check with your husband? And the women just, you know, explode in laughter. And it's like, where does this white woman come from? She said, for a minute, I forgot I was with women who had absolute control of their own property. Because white women didn't. Once you married, you became the property of your husband, essentially. You lost all your legal rights, all your legal existence. You ceased to exist legally. So of course you couldn't vote. Of course you couldn't own your own property, have your own wages given to you. They were given to your husband. You had no right to your children even. A husband could will away an unborn child. You had no right to safety. Your husband had the right to beat you. So here are these white women seeing women's rights in action. They're seeing women who have their own authority, who have political, social, religious voice at a time when they had none of those. And I think that's what inspired them to think this is possible. I've seen it in action. I've been told it's not possible, but I've seen it.
Sally, we have to take a break in less than a minute. I just want to point out, though, that it's not just early Native societies that you point out that had rights for women, but early colonies had women voting. What happened?
Well, property rights were the qualification. If you had enough property, if you were a man or a woman, you could vote. When the states formed their constitutions, they got away from property qualifications, and instead they inserted race and gender qualifications. So it became illegal for women and African-American men to vote, and that was in all the states.
Wow. We'll pick the story up on the other side of a break. We have a whole lot yet to learn about the women's suffrage movement, which is the title of Sally Resch Wagner's book. She is the editor. There is a lot of work by a lot of other writers in here. We'll come back and talk more with Sally about the people in the book and the things they witnessed when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Sally Resch Wagner, who got one of the first PhDs ever awarded for women's studies in the United States. She's currently adjunct faculty at Syracuse University, a member of the New York State Women's Suffrage Commission, and the editor of a big book with a lot of writing by a lot of different writers during the women's suffrage movement. So the book is, of course, called The Women's Suffrage Movement. Gloria Steinem provided a foreword. You can provide some comment. Let's hear what you think about what happened to women in the United States of America and why it took so darn long, 99 years ago, to get the right to vote for all of them. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Gloria Steinem's foreword reminds us that even people who fought slavery were okay with no women's rights. Is that right?
That, you know, the thing that is painful about the movement is that there was this very strong connection between abolitionists and women's rights workers that was broken. And it was first broken really with the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment struggle. And that was after the Civil War, when the Constitution, which was a slavery document, had to be revised. Enslaved people were considered 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation, figuring out how many representatives you'd have in the House of Representatives. So once enslavement was abolished, it was necessary to change the Constitution. Well, this was a moment when the abolitionists, the women's rights workers, came together, formed the American Equal Rights Association, and said, we are working together for universal suffrage. Everyone should have the vote in this moment. But the radical Republicans who had control of Congress said, Not going to happen. We're going to let African-American men vote, but we're not going to let women vote. And what that did was to break that coalition apart in a really ugly way. And racism rose from the women's voices then, the white women's voices. But it, I think, was the radical Republicans, the politicians, that broke apart a coalition and did not seize an historic moment when we really could have moved democracy forward with everyone having a vote.
Was it incrementalism, you think, that we can only do one or the other but not both?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Expediency, this will be easier to get through. This we can be sure. The other would take longer. I think the politics of expediency, which we use in this country, what it does is it allows us to win the battle, but we lose the longer war. And that just takes longer, and it makes a legacy of conflict that is so difficult to eradicate.
Let me take just a little side channel here then, but I mean, because I understand what you're saying about expediency. You don't just settle for what you think you can get because you know the votes are lined up for you. Push a little harder. But how do you know when you're pushing too hard and getting into a position of we will not compromise, which has certainly been a hallmark of Congresses in recent years?
Mm-hmm. I think that if we look at, you know, are we moving forward? Are we moving freedom forward? I think the critical thing is, what are we doing with our demanding it all? Are we demanding that we can hold on to the entrenched power that exists? That's a very different thing than saying, no, we are moving freedom forward, and we're not going to settle for just one group making it. We're not going to divide and conquer. We're going to say everybody needs to have the same rights.
And it's almost like physics when we talk about history in the senses that we're talking about here. And you add to that, Dr. Wagner, with your references in the book to dams. Could you explain the way you view our view of history as setting up dams in streams?
Well, I think that, you know, it's history is a process. And the way in which we typically interpret it is that it is great men, great deeds that create history. Well, Abraham Lincoln didn't free the slaves. It was the abolitionists who pushed him to that position. Douglas said, Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. And I think that we move forward and then there's a block in the road. We move forward, there's a block in the road. And the established power, whatever it is always wanting to hold on to that power, hold on to that privilege, and pushing against that. We're constantly pushing upstream in the process of making history, and it is not individuals. It is a movement that moves history forward, that moves freedom forward.
Sally Resch Wagner is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the editor of the big book, The Women's Suffrage Movement. It's the writing of a lot of people involved in women's suffrage over the years. Matilda Jocelyn Gage is a bit of a rock star in here with many essays. Why to this day is she somewhat less known than her contemporaries?
Well, she actually, at a time when the movement was bringing in religious fundamentalists who wanted to put God in the Constitution, Jesus Christ as the head of the government, and create a fundamentalist Christian nation. Gage said, that is the great danger of the hour. It's not, if we lose religious freedom, it's not going to matter who votes. And so she went up against that conservative Christian power structure that really was pushing that agenda, and it went against the entrenched woman suffrage movement, which at that point was courting the conservative Christian women. And she becomes persona non grata. She drops out of the movement, and she really is lost to history in that process.
Wow. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton was one of her contemporaries, and mm-hmm. she is in here writing about the transition from mother age to father age in mm-hmm. history. When did she see that happening, or when was her thesis on that?
I think for both Gage and for Stanton, it was that there were historically indigenous cultures that then became Christianized, and in the process of what Gage called political religions setting in, that brought in the subjugation of women.
So it sounds like it runs hand in hand with monotheism.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
All right. So then we talk about Minister Samuel May, obviously the one of the professors of a monotheistic religion. What did he do to get in this book?
Well, he was a Unitarian minister who, in 1845, 3 years before the Seneca Falls Convention, the first local convention that we know about that was held for women's rights. 3 years before that, he preaches a sermon in his pulpit in Syracuse, New York, in which he says, "How would you men feel if women made all the decisions for you? How would you feel if they owned your property? How would you feel if, you know," and he just goes through the process, and then he says, "You men need to become more Christ-like, and you women need to become more aggressive." And as far as I know, it's as far as I could find, it's the first woman's rights sermon preached in the country.
Wow, that's impressive. In 1845, you say 3 years before Seneca Falls.
Yep.
Wow. And then William Ray, a newspaper editor, is mentioned in the same section of the book. What did he do?
Well, you know, it's that we think that it's all women, and we think that it begins in 1848. I mean, this is at a constitutional convention in the 1820s, and Ray writes this delightful poem in which he basically says, "Look, if you men don't give women their rights, we may have a little Lysistrata situation here. The women may cut you off," and this is the humor in 1826. Was the date. And, you know, there men are struggling with the issue, and there are male allies from the very beginning.
We are again talking to Sally Resch Wagner from New York State about the women's suffrage movement, which is both obviously what the subject matter is, but also the title of the book she edited with the writings of many, many people who worked on behalf of women getting the right to vote in America. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Your thoughts about the long history of women struggling and why they had to struggle just to get the right to vote that men had upon the establishment of the Republic. Join us on The Exchange with your thoughts, comments, questions, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Yeah, the second section of the book is all about how women organized before Seneca Falls, and you talked about that local convention 3 years before. And then even before that, there was a convention in Pennsylvania in 1839, and a mob set fire to the place?
Yes. This was... Many people now are dating the women's rights movement in the U.S. to the female anti-slavery societies. First one was formed by African-American women in 1832 in Salem, Massachusetts. By 1837, they have organized nationally, and it is a mixed organization of black and white women all working to end slavery. Now, they're not working for their rights precisely at this point, but you know one of the rights they're working for women? They're calling out the institutionalized rape of enslaved women in the South. And we think of this as at a time when women couldn't talk about anything about sex. Well, they are taking that issue on. It's the first, I think, women's rights issue that they really deal with. But they're gaining their political voice during this time. They're learning how to organize. They're exercising their right of petition. They're forming into organizations, and that then allows them, once they start forming organizations for women's rights, they've got the background by then. They know how to do it.
So what you were just talking about, though, where we're anti-slavery activists are the ones who pointed out that female slaves were raped with regularity. Mm-hmm. I think of how politics work now, and indignation is expressed at the way the other side talks. And I wonder if the fact that they even dared to bring up a subject like rape, and I'm using dared in quotes here, obviously, led some people to just write them off as being vulgar or disgusting or something.
Everything they did. gave, you know, people who were committed to the established power relations with men holding women in, you know, authority. You know, you take a step forward, and people are going to be threatened by that. And there's going to be backlash. It's inevitable in any revolutionary movement for democracy.
There was a certain level of genius in the declaration at Seneca Falls that it followed very closely the wording of the Declaration of Independence. And I wonder what the broad reaction to that might have been at the time.
Well, it was mixed. You know, of course, they said they carried the declaration all the way along, and then they said all men and women are created equal. And placing that gender definitely in the Constitution or the Declaration of Rights, it changes the whole nature of it. Generic men does not necessarily always include women, and they made sure the women would be separately. I think that the reaction was mixed. You know, Frederick Douglass's paper a year before the Women's Rights Convention had as its masthead, "Right is of no sex. Truth is of no color." He put the cause of women before his own. And he, of course, wrote, he was at the convention, he supported the resolution for women voting, and he wrote a very positive review of the meeting. Other newspapers found it horrific. They found it humorous. They found it, you know, totally unacceptable. So that's what you expect when you're pushing the envelope toward freedom.
Right. You get a whole range of reactions from praise to out-and-out ridicule. And
exactly.
I want to bring up another name in here, Harriet Hunt. What was the heart of her work for women's rights?
Oh, you know, one of the things that she did, she demanded that women be educated as they were not being educated in the Boston public school system. But she also, she refused to pay her taxes early on. And she said, you know, no taxation without representation. That becomes then, once the movement organizes, that becomes one of the strategies. The National Woman Suffrage Association conducted a decade-long, it was a campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience. And it began with the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, when they launched a tax protest campaign. You know, why should we pay our taxes when we're not represented? Does this sound a little familiar from history? Then they protested at the unveiling of the Statue of Liberty. They said it's the greatest hypocrisy of the 19th century that woman is represented, or liberty is represented as a woman in a nation where not a single woman has political liberty. And they presented a Declaration of Rights of Women at the 1876 centennial celebration. They knew they would probably be arrested. They weren't. But they said, we did this not for the women of our time, but for the daughters of 1976, so they would know that the mothers of 1876 had impeached the government for its treatment of women.
I don't know why that particular passage sent a bolt through my heart, but having them talk about our time, it's like, hey, they know we're here.
Isn't that, that's what, you know, I was in a library reading this in the history of women's suffrage, and I broke down in tears, and that was part of the impetus for the book. You know, it was, we didn't know that they did this for us.
That's true, and I guess that is the great power of it. Okay, I felt it too. Let's take a call here. We have Greg in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sally Resch Wagner, the editor of the Women's Suffrage Movement.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I wondered if in your studies, recognizing that just having political rights is not necessarily the same as having civil rights, you had noticed the impact of the availability of bicycles to women in the mid and late 1800s. I noticed that their comments about their sense of liberation was very similar to the ones that I'm hearing from the women in Saudi Arabia, who are finally able to experience some increase in their own personal mobility.
Because they can drive. Yeah, transportation and liberation in correlation. Let's talk about that, Sally.
That's an excellent connection that you paint there. I actually hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. That's the same. You know, women no longer had to have somebody accompanying them. They could be on their own in a bicycle, but it also required a change in dress because women, if we think about, you know, oh, the burqa, what a terrible thing. Well, women in the 19th century, women of a certain means, were from the time they were children, 10 years old, they would start corseting. The goal was to get your waist cinched in to a 19-inch waist, so that your beau, your lover, could put his fingers around your waist, encircle your waist. You know, women removed ribs. They died in childbirth as a result of all their organs becoming distended from that terrible corseting. Elizabeth Cady Stanton saw it in ways as worse than the foot binding of women in China, because corseting killed and foot binding didn't necessarily do that. So in order to ride a bicycle, you had to have a little better clothing, and the two, dress reform and mobility, moved in some ways together.
All right, we'll come back to the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange with Sally Resch Wagner, the editor of the Women's Suffrage Movement. Your phone calls and emails welcome when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking live to Sally Resch Wagner, who was one of the first PhDs in the country for women's studies. She's adjunct faculty now at Syracuse University and a member of the New York State Women's Suffrage Commission. So she's been talking about women's suffrage for a very long time. Collects some of the better essays and writings about women's suffrage from the time of the movement into a single volume called simply The Women's Suffrage Movement, with a foreword by Gloria Steinem. You can join our conversation on the Exchange with your thoughts, your questions, your comments about the long struggle to get women the right to vote in the United States, finally delivered in the 19th Amendment in 1920. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. As the book goes on, you give us a sense of just how broad a coalition this was, with a spectrum ranging from fairly tepid efforts to get some rights for women to trying to get all the way to free love. I mean, was this a fairly noisy and uneasy coalition at many times?
You know, movements are not smooth. They're not clear. They're messy. And that's the power of, you're dealing with a whole lot of issues, you're sorting them out, you're pushing the world forward, and you don't know what's out there. You don't know what you're going to be able to create. You make terrible mistakes. You screw up badly. But somehow, you're able to move the possibility of human liberation forward. Yeah, it was, they were raising everything. Sometimes we look tepid compared to what they were talking about and dealing with during that time.
You'd already mentioned, Sally, the National Women's Suffrage Association, the NWSA. There was also an AWSA, yeah. Two distinct organizations. How did their approaches differ?
I think one of the major differences was that the AWSA said, we're going to work for the vote state by state. Now, this was a time when it was unclear who would be able to control citizenship. Was it the federal government or was it states? Once you had the 14th or 15th Amendment, which gave African American men the vote, it was, well, the federal government has done it, so maybe the federal government can. The National Woman Suffrage Association worked for a federal amendment. The American worked for states. Now, think about what was going on at this time. This was when radical Reconstruction, the attempt to really protect African Americans after the end of the Civil War, it was breaking down. And the voter restriction laws were going into place in force. There was violence against the African Americans. Ku Klux Klan was rising. Think about the implications of saying, give women the right to vote. If the states can give women the right to vote, can't they also take it away from African American men? What it does is it undermines the federal protection of the ballot for African American men. And I think that really shows a major difference between the two groups. Most of the African American suffragists, male and female, went with the National Woman Suffrage Association.
So, Sally, did the women's rights effort go dormant during the Civil War consciously, or was it just less noticed?
It was very conscious. Mm-hmm. 1850s, the anti-slavery group and the women's rights group, they held their conventions concurrently, so you could go to one and the other. If you scratched a suffragist, you would find an abolitionist. You scratched an abolitionist, you would find a suffragist. It's the same people you're writing about when you're writing about both movements. But after during the Civil War, the women's rights advocates said, you know what? We're going to suspend our effort, and we are going to support the war effort. But we will only support it if it's being fought to end slavery. Lincoln at the time was saying the war is being fought to preserve the Union. Well, they gathered 400,000 signatures, the largest number of signatures that had ever been gathered on United States soil. People saying we will only support the war effort if it's fought to end slavery.
Wow. That had an impact. There's another speech from the time of the war itself, Angelina Grimke Weld's speech from 1863. She was from South Carolina, but what position was she establishing?
Well, I think that the Angelina Grimke and her sister Sarah were amazing. They were they came from slave-owning family in the South. They freed their slaves, and then they came North, and they gave testimony about what it was to be enslaved in the South from the perspective of a slave owner, an ex-slave owner, and it had profound impact in the North. Initially, they were only supposed to speak to women-only audiences, but men showed up, and so those are called promiscuous assemblies because women and men were not supposed to appear in public together, and women were not supposed to speak publicly. So the Grimke sisters really pushed the envelope on that.
So here's where things really get surprising in the divergence of the two movements, the abolition movement and the women's rights movement, women's suffrage movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote about opposing the 15th Amendment.
I think that was the moment when they were working for universal suffrage. And once Congress, the Republicans in charge of Congress, in control of it, said, nope, we're only going to go for the vote for African-American men. It was, what am I going to do? Am I going to step back and say, okay, we'll take what we can get now? And some of the women and some of the men said yes. It was really not divided, black and white men and women, interestingly. You have Robert Purvis, an African-American suffragist abolitionist, who said, I have a son and a daughter. I would rather that my son wait for 50 years to get the vote rather than that my daughter wait for one more moment, because as a Negro and as a woman, she is doubly in need of the protection of the ballot. So he was not in favor of the 15th Amendment. He wanted universal suffrage. This was when expediency set in, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton was angry. Did she make racist statements at that time? You bet she did. And she needs to be held accountable for those. It was a time of division. And I think that, you know, had Congress looked for the long haul rather than the moment of, well, we'll let some people in, but not everybody, our lives would be different today.
It is interesting to sit where we sit now at such a remove in time to think about the things they faced and why they wouldn't just say, well, you know, we're going to end up doing this at some point. Maybe not us, maybe not our kids, maybe our grandkids will end up doing this, which ultimately is what happened. But they just couldn't see the end of the road at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing. Virginia Minor, another name in here, took a case for voting all the way to the Supreme Court. What happened in the case?
Well, this was part of their civil disobedience campaign. They said, look, we are citizens of a republic. It's based on the consent of the governed. We have the right to vote. The lawbreakers are the states that are denying us our natural right to suffrage. So what they did was they voted. They pushed the envelope. They presented themselves as voters. And when, you know, Susan B. Anthony was a test case, was arrested, fined $100, refused to pay it. But these were hundreds of women around the country, maybe thousands. The ones who couldn't register to vote, some of them took their cases to court, suing the registrars that were denying them the right to register to vote. Virginia Minor was one of them. She, of course, didn't take the case to the Supreme Court. It was her husband, because as a married woman, she could neither sue nor be sued. So Frances Minor's husband was a dedicated to the women's suffrage cause. They took it to the Supreme Court, sued Reese Happersat for $10,000 for refusing to allow Virginia Minor to vote or to register to vote. The Supreme Court, nine white men, said, if unanimously, if there is one case that can be settled now and forever, it is this one. Women do not have the right to vote guaranteed in the United States.
Ouch. 9-0. Yeah.
Okay. 1875. Virginia Minor continued to refuse to pay her taxes.
Good for her. So we've already talked about the property rights that women had, which were negligible in most cases. We talked about corsets and their mangling of their bodies. Let's move on to reproductive rights, because you blew my mind here, Sally, where you mentioned that a lot of the birth control we know now was available by 1870.
It was. The safe, effective forms of birth control, diaphragm, cervical cap, condoms, spermicide, those were available. And it was the religious fundamentalists who got laws passed making it illegal to give information about reproductive choice and information about abortions that brought the possibility legally of controlling reproduction to an end. Until the 1960s, when I think it was 62, when the final Comstock law was overturned by the Supreme Court. And boom, all of a sudden there's all these pharmaceutical forms of birth control, and the media is extolling the fact that finally women have the right to control their own bodies. Yeah. Well, could have happened a lot earlier, and it did happen a lot earlier, but it was stopped.
Wow, that's amazing. This, not that the just the information, blocking the information is something. It just shows, again, the power of information. So we've already talked about NWSA and AWSA. They did end up merging, and I wonder what the new NASA or any other women's rights groups did as African Americans began losing rights in the South as Reconstruction was undone after 1876.
Yeah, and this was a moment when I think this is when we really need to hold the movement accountable, because they took actions that they should not have taken, and they didn't take actions that they should have taken, and they knew better. The National American focused on states' rights, as the American had done. And what they did was allow the states, the state auxiliaries, to do whatever they wanted. They said, you know, you can practice states' rights. And in the South, some of the state auxiliaries segregated their organizations. They worked for the vote for white women only, and they worked for Jim Crow laws, voter suppression laws. So they not only, you know, didn't help African American men, they set them back, and they set back the possibility of African American women voting. The National American made the argument, you know, give women the right to vote because it's a way to maintain white native-born supremacy, because we white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants. And I think that, you know, some of these women were the former abolitionists. Susan B. Anthony, for example, they knew what they were doing. They did it, they said, because we have to have the South. But what would have happened if they would have instead made a coalition, instead of making a coalition with white male racists in the South, they would have made a coalition with African American men and supported their right to vote. If they would have made coalition with immigrants instead of fighting to get them disenfranchised, if they would have fought to work together to ensure that, you know, they would have allies that would support them, you know, things might have been different. I really think about how many lives of African American men might have been saved if the woman suffragists would have worked against lynching with Ida B. Wells when she asked them to.
There's a lot to consider there. And, of course, an ultimate irony here is that the state that put the 19th Amendment over the top was Tennessee. We've explored some of this history on the program before, but what happened in the election following Tennessee confirming the 19th Amendment to the people who supported it?
You tell me.
Most of them lost, didn't they?
You know, what happened in the South, once the voter suppression laws were in place, once the women had lost the reason for getting the vote, you know, they stopped fighting for all those rights they'd been fighting for, and they forgot why they got the vote. And so the history after the amendment is passed is a really sad example of what happens when you practice expediency and you don't work for everything.
Okay, another warning against expediency from Sally Resch Wagner, the editor of the Women's Suffrage Movement. Thank you so much for joining us. That'll do it for today's exchange.